Hacking History. Pleasure Empires. They will welcome you as a prince among princes, and they will worship you as a god among gods. They will wipe the sweat from your brow and the dust of the road from your feet, and they will offer to you their sons and daughters and the wine of their vineyards. Their world exists only to please the angels of the celestial court, and we have granted you this leave to dwell among our worshippers, with all the rights and honors of a god made flesh. They will bring wine unto you, and the fruit of the dream poppy. They will clothe you in silk and gold, and lie naked beneath your feet, and abase themselves before your every whim. They are the people of the pleasure empires, established from time to time by the decree of the lords of Stasis to serve their loyal servants, and it is their honor and their duty to obey you and demonstrate their love for you in any way that you desire, for all their days and lifetimes upon the earth. And you will dwell among them in a palace of alabaster, surrounded by gardens of delight, and you shall want for nothing. Your days of pleasure will number 1,001. Your lovers will number 1,000 or 1, as you please. Your pleasures will be without number, and the number of tomorrow's parties shall be beyond measure. You need not leave until the pleasures of flesh and mind pale, and the novelty of infinite luxury becomes a weight on your soul. Then, and only then, you will yearn for the duty which lends meaning to life. Energized, you will return to service with serenity and enthusiasm, and your colleagues will turn aside from their tasks and wonder at your eagerness. For though you may have spent a century in the pleasure empires, your absence from your duty will have lasted barely a heartbeat. You are a loyal servant of the Stasis, and you may return to paradise whenever it pleases you, because we want you to be happy in your work. Palimpsest Ambush. Almost 100 kiloyears had passed since the Yellowstone eruption that wiped out the Benzin and the hunter-gatherer tribes of the Gulf Coast. The new receding was 12,000 years old. Civilization had taken root again, spreading around the planet with the efflorescent enthusiasm of a parasitic vine. It was currently going through an expansionist, mercantilist phase, scattered city-states and tribute empires gradually coalescing and moving toward a tentative enlightenment. Eventually, they'd rediscover electronics, and, with the institution of a ubiquitous surveillance program, finally reconquer the heights of true civilization. Nobody looking at the flourishing cities and the white-sailed trade ships could imagine that the people who built them were destined for anything but glory. Pierce stumbled along a twisty cobbled lane off the Chandler Street and Carnegra, doing his faux drunken best to look like part of the scenery. Sailors fresh ashore from Ipsolian League boats weren't a rarity here, and it'd certainly explain his lack of fluency in Imagra, the local Creole. It was another training assignment, but with 6 more years subjective of training and a stasis phone implant, Pierce now had some degree of independence. He was trusted to work away from the watchful eyes of his supervisor, on assignments deemed safe for a probationer agent. Proceed to the Red Duck on Margrave Way at the 3rd hour of Corps Day. Take your detox first, and stay on the small beer. You're there as a level 1 observer and level 0 exit decoy to cover our other agent's departure. There's going to be a fight, and you need to be ready to look after yourself. But remember, you're meant to be a drunken sailor, so you need to look the part until things kick off. Once your target is out of the picture, you're free to leave. If it turns hot, escalate it to me, and I'll untangle things retroactively. It was all straightforward stuff, although normally Pierce wouldn't be assigned to a job in Carnegra, or indeed to any job in this epoch. Training to blend in seamlessly with an alien culture was difficult enough that stasis agents usually worked in their home era, or as close to it as possible, where their local knowledge was most useful. As it was, 2 months of full-time study had given him just enough background to masquerade as a foreign sailor, in an archipelagian society that was still 3 centuries away from reinventing the telegraph. It's a personalized test, he'd realized with a jittery shudder of alertness, as if he'd just drowned a mug of mate. Someone up the line in operational analysis would be watching his performance, judging his flexibility. He determined to give it his all. It took him 2 months of hard training in language and cultural studies and local field procedures, all for less than 6 hours on the ground in Carnegra. And the reason he was certain it was a test, Supervisor Hark had changed the subject when he'd asked who he was there to cover for. Margrave Way was a cobblestoned alley, stepped every few meters to allow for the slope of the hillside, lined on either side with the single-story bamboo shop fronts of fishmongers and chandlers. Pierce threaded his wobbly way around servants out shopping for the daily catch, water carriers, fruit and vegetable sellers, and beggars. Dodged a rice merchant's train of dwarf dromedaries loaded with sacks, and avoided a pair of black-robed scholars from one of the seminaries that straggled around the flanks of the hill like the thinning air on the pate of an elderly priest. Banners rippled in the weak onshore breeze. Paper skull-lanterns with mirror-polished eyes to repel evil spirits bounced gaudily beneath the eaves as he entered the inn. The red duck was painted the color of its namesake. Pierce hunched beneath the low awning and probed the gloom carefully, finally emerging into the yard out back with his eyes watering. At this hour the yard was half empty, for the tavern made much of its trade in food. The scent of honeysuckle hung heavy over the decking. The hibiscus bushes at the sides of the yard were riotously red. Pierce staked out a bench near the rear wall with a clear view of the entrance and the latrines, then unobtrusively audited the other patrons, careful to avoid eye contact. Even half-empty, the yard held the publican's young sons, shuffling hither and yon to fill cups for the customers. Four presumably genuine drunken sailors, three liveried servants from the seminaries, a couple of gaudily clad women whose burlesque approach to the sailors was blatantly professional, and three cloak-shrouded pilgrims from the highlands of what had once been Cascadia, presumably come to visit the shrines and holy baths of the southern lands, at least to a first approximation. One of the lads was at Pierce's elbow, asking something about service and food.
"Give beer," Pierce managed haltingly. "Good beer, light, 2 coin value."
The tap boy vanished, returned with a stoneware mug full of warm suds that smelled faintly of bananas.
"Good, good."
Pierce fumbled with his change, pawing over it as if unsure. He passed 2 clipped and blackened coins to the kid, both threaded with passive RF transceivers, beacons to tell his contact that they were not alone. As Pierce raised his mug to his lips in unfeigned happy anticipation, his phone buzzed. It was a disturbing sensation, utterly unnatural, and it had taken him much practice to learn not to jump when it happened. He scanned the beer garden, concealing his mouth with his mug as he did so. A murder of crows, seminary students flocking to the watering hole, was raucously establishing its pecking order in the vestibule. One of the sailors had fallen forward across the table while his fellow tried to rouse him, and a working girl in a red wrap was walking toward the back wall, humming tunelessly. Bingo, he thought, with a smug flicker of satisfaction. Pierce twitched a stomach muscle, goosing his phone. The other stasis agent would feel a shiver and buzz like an angry yellow jacket. And indeed, as he watched, the woman in red glanced round abruptly. Pierce twitched again as her gaze flickered over him. This time involuntarily, in the grip of something akin to déjà vu.
Can't be, he realized an instant later. She wouldn't be on a field op like this.
The woman in red turned and sidestepped toward his bench, sub-vocalizing.
You're my cover, yes? Let's get out of here right now. It's going bad.
Pierce began to stand.
Yarrow?
He asked. The sailor, who was trying to rouse his friend, started tugging at his shoulder.
Yes? Look, what's your exit plan?
She sounded edgy.
But...
He froze, his stomach twisting. She doesn't know me, he realized.
Sorry. Can you get over the wall if I create a diversion?
He sent, his heart hammering. He hadn't seen her in 3 years subjective. She'd blown through his life like a runaway train, then vanished as abruptly as she'd arrived, leaving behind a scrawled note to say she'd been called uptime by control, and a final quick charcoal sketch.
I think so, but there are 2.
The sailor stood up and shouted incoherently at her just as Pierce's phone buzzed again.
Who's that?
She asked.
Hard contact in 5 seconds.
The other agent, whoever he was, sounded urgent.
Stay back!
The sailor shouted again, and this time Pierce understood it.
Murderer!
He climbed over the table and drew a long curved knife, moving forward.
Get behind me.
Pierce stepped between Yarrow and the sailor, his thoughts a chaotic mess of this is stupid, and what did she do, and who else, as he paged Supervisor Hark.
Peace,
he said in faltering Carnegrin.
Am friend. Want drink?
Behind the angry sailor, the priest students were standing up, black robes flapping as they spread out, calling to one another. Yarrow retreated behind him. His phone vibrated again, then, improbably, a fourth time. There were too many agents.
"What's happening?" asked Hark.
"I think it's a palimpsest," Pierce managed to send.
Like an inked parchment scrubbed clean and reused, a section of history that had been multiply overwritten. He held his hands up, addressed the sailor.
"You want... thing... money?"
The third agent, who'd warned of contact.
"Drop now!"
Pierce began to fall as something, someone, Yarrow, grabbed his shoulder and pushed sideways. One of the students let his robe slide open. It slid down from his shoulders, gaping to reveal an iridescent fluidity that followed the rough contours of a human body, flexing and rippling like molten glass. Its upper margin flowed and swelled around its wearer's neck and chin, bulging upward to engulf his head as he stepped out of the black scholar's robe. The sailor held his knife high, point down as he advanced on Pierce. Pierce's focus narrowed as he brought his fall under control, preparing to roll and trigger the telescopic baton in his sleeve. A gunshot, shockingly loud, split the afternoon air. The sailor's head disappeared in a crimson haze, splattering across Pierce's face. The corpse lurched and collapsed like a dropped sack. Somebody, Yarrow, cried out behind him, as Pierce pushed back with his left arm, trying to blink the red fog from his vision. The student's robe was taking on a life of its own, contracting and standing up like a malign shadow behind its master as the human-shaped blob of walking water turned and raised one hand toward the roof. A chorus of screams rose behind it as one of the other seminarians, who had unwisely reached for the robe, collapsed, convulsing.
"Stay down!"
It was the third agent.
"Play dead!" "My knees!"
Pierce managed a sidelong look that took in Yarrow's expression of fear with a shudder of self-recognition.
"I'll decoy," he sent.
Then, a curious clarity of purpose in his mind, he rolled sideways and scrambled toward the interior of the tavern. Several things happened in the next 3 seconds. First, a brilliant turquoise circle 2 meters in diameter flickered open, hovering directly in front of the rear wall of the beer garden. A double handful of enormous purple hornets burst from its surface. Most arrowed toward the students, who had entangled themselves in a panicky crush at the exit. 2 turned and darted straight up toward the balcony level. Next, a spark, bright as lightning, leapt between the watery humanoid's upraised hand and the ceiling. Finally, something punched Pierce in the chest with such breathtaking violence that he found, to his shock and surprise, that his hands and feet didn't seem to want to work anymore.
"Agent down!"
someone signaled, and it seemed to him that this was something he ought to make sense of, but sense was ebbing fast in a buzz of angry hornets as the pinkness faded to gray. And then everything was quiet for a long time. Internal Affairs.
"Do you know anyone who wants you dead, Scala Agent?"
The investigator from Internal Affairs leaned over Pierce, his hands clasped together in a manner that reminded Pierce of a hungry mantis. His ears, Pierce couldn't help but notice, were prominent and pink, little radar dishes adorning the sides of a thin face. It had to be an ironic comment, if not an outright insult, his adoption of the likeness of Franz Kafka. Or perhaps the man from Internal Affairs simply didn't want to be recognized. Pierce chuckled weakly. The results were predictable. When the coughing fit subsided, and his vision began to clear again, he shook his head.
"A pity."
Kafka rocked backward slightly, his shoulders hunched.
"It would make things easier."
Pierce risked a question.
"Does the library have anything?"
Kafka sniffed.
"Of course not. Whoever set the trap knew enough to scrub the palimpsest clean before they embarked on their killing spree."
So it was a palimpsest. Pierce felt vaguely cheated.
"They assassinated themselves first? To remove the evidence from the time sequence?"
"You died 3 times, Scala Agent, not counting your present state."
He gestured at the dressing covering the cardiac assist leech clamped to the side of Pierce's chest. It pulsed rhythmically, taking the load while the new heart grew to full size between his ribs.
"Agent Yarrow died 2 times, and Agent Major Alizade's report states that he was forced to invoke Control Majeure to contain the palimpsest's expansion. Someone..."
Kafka leaned toward Pierce again, peering intently at his face with disturbingly dark eyes.
"Went to great lengths to kill you repeatedly."
Pierce stared at the ceiling of his hospital room,
where plaster cherubs clutching overflowing cornucopiae cavorted with lecherous satyrs.
I suppose you want to know why.
No. Having read your branch library file, there are any number of whys. What I want to know is why now.
Kafka smiled, his mouth widening until his alarmingly unhinged head seemed ready to topple from the plinth of his jaw.
You're still in training, a green shoot, an interesting time to pick on you, don't you think?
Fear made Pierce tense up.
If you've read my library record, you must know I'm loyal.
Peace.
Kafka made a placating gesture.
I know nothing of the kind. The library can't tell me what's inside your head. But you're not under suspicion of trying to assassinate yourself. What I do know is that so far your career has been notably mundane. The library branches are as prone to overwrites as any other palimpsest. But we may be able to make deductions about your attacker by looking for inconsistencies between your memories and the version of your history documented locally.
Pierce lay back, drained. I'm not under suspicion.
What is to become of me? He asked.
Kafka's smile vanished.
Nothing for now. You may convalesce at your leisure, and sooner or later you will learn whatever it is that was so important to our enemies that they tried to erase you. When you do so, I would be grateful if you would call me.
He rose to leave.
You will see me again eventually. Meanwhile, you should bear in mind that you have come to the attention of important persons. Consider yourself lucky, and try to make the best of it.
3 days after Kafka's departure, summoned back, no doubt, to the vasty abyss of deep time in which internal affairs held their council, Pierce had another visitor.
I came to thank you, she said haltingly. You didn't need to do that. To decoy, I mean. I'm very grateful.
It had the sound of a prepared speech, but Pierce didn't mind. She was young and eye-wrenchingly desirable, even in the severe uniform of an agent initiate.
You would have died again, he pointed out. I was your backup.
It's bad form to let your primary die. And I owed you.
You owed me? But we haven't met. There's nothing about you in my library file.
Her pupils dilated. It was an older you, he said mildly. While the stasis held a file on everyone, agents were only permitted to see and annotate those of their own details that lay in their past. After a pause, he admitted,
I was hoping we might meet again sometime. But I...
She hesitated, then stared at him, narrowing her eyes.
I'm not in the market. I have a partner.
Funny, she didn't tell me that. He closed his eyes for a few seconds.
She said we had a history, though.
And to tell her when I first met her that her first pet, a cat named Chloe, died when a wild dog took her. Pierce opened his eyes to stare at the Baroque ceiling again.
I'm sorry I asked, yeah, esteemed colleague. Please forgive me. I didn't think you were for sale. My heart is simply in the wrong place.
After a second, he heard a shocked, incongruous giggle.
I gather armor-piercing rounds usually have that effect, he added.
When she was able to speak again, she shook her head.
I am sincere, Scholar Agent. Pierce? Pierced? Oh, dear.
She managed to hold her dignity intact, this time, despite a gleam of amusement.
I'm sorry if I don't mean to doubt you. But you must know, if you know me, I have never met you, yes?
That thought has indeed occurred to me. The leech pulsed warmly against his chest, squirting blood through the aortic shunt.
As you can see, right now I am not only heartless but harmless, insofar as I won't even be able to get out of bed unaided for another 10 days. You need not fear that I'm going to pursue you. I merely thought to introduce myself and let you know, as she did to me, that we could have a history, if you're so inclined, someday. But not right now, obviously.
But obviously not. She stood up. This wasn't what I was expecting.
Me neither.
He smiled bitterly.
It never is it?
She paused in the doorway.
I'm not saying no, never, Scholar Agent. But not now, obviously. Some other time. We'll worry about that if we meet again, perhaps. History can wait a little longer. Oh, and thank you for saving my life some of the times. 1 out of 3 is good going, especially for a student.